I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Most of us have felt anxious at one time or another, but for some, anxiety can be a debilitating condition. Our guest, Daniel Smith, has been chronically anxious for most of his life. And according to what he writes in his new memoir, Monkey Mind, he comes by it naturally. It runs in the family. He says that his mother is overtly anxious, while his father was more controlled about his anxiety. For his brother, it's physical, and for him, the anxiety is more cerebral. Daniel Smith's memoir is a fascinating and at times painful, heartbreaking, hilarious, and insightful account of living with anxiety. Daniel Smith is a writer, a journalist. His work has appeared in The Atlantic Magazine, Granta, New York Magazine, The New York Times Book Review, The New York Times Magazine, and Slate. He actually began his career as a staff editor at The Atlantic Monthly. He holds the Mary Ellen Donnelly Critchlow Endowed Chair in English at the College of New Rochelle, located just outside of New York City. And he joins us today on Radio Times from the New York Bureau, the New York NPR Bureau, I should say. And Daniel Smith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. And I was curious, are you anxious about doing this interview?
Strangely, I'm not. I was anxious beforehand for a while. I was biting my nails, biting my cuticles. But something about once you're in the middle of it, it cuts off the fear of the future, which is what anxiety often is, and sort of slams you right into the present moment. And for me, talking to someone even live in front of an audience, mm-hmm. all my anxiety goes away. I used to do some performance in college, and beforehand, I was an absolute wreck always, and felt tortured. But once I was up there, the anxiety dissipated. It was like meditating. It was like being always in the present moment. So something about that. Not everyone who's anxious.
Right.
Is so lucky, of course.
Well, I'm glad you're not anxious, and we're happy
to
have you here. You, though, describe your anxiety as cerebral, and you have a wonderful phrase describing, I guess, how your brain works, a kind of drama queen of the mind. Help us understand what goes on inside your head that makes you so anxious.
Right. Well, the term that I think clinicians use is catastrophizing, so that anything that happens, even the most mundane thing, a thought might occur to me regarding that event, and it could be anything mundane, like which salad dressing to put on my garden salad. Should it be balsamic vinaigrette? It should be blue cheese. Now, it seems like a very mundane choice, a very pedestrian choice, but for me, my mind immediately starts making a logical progression from that moment to catastrophic events. If I choose the wrong salad dressing, I'll have a bad lunch and I won't be very nice to the person next to me. That person next to me will say something terrible about me, who will say something to my editor, who will cancel my book contract, which will lead to me to being impoverished and then homeless. I'll take up drugs. I'll end up having to sell my body for money on the streets, come down with a horrible disease, and die disgraced and alone.
Wow. A vivid imagination, yes?
Yeah, dramatic, melodramatic mind. It is like having a drama queen of the mind. That's one great metaphor, at least for my anxiety.
Well, it's interesting because you do talk about your family and how you experience anxiety differently. And it sounds like, as you say, with your brother, it's more physical, maybe more kind of heart palpitations. But for you, it is this cerebral, your overactive brain, I guess.
Yeah, and I think my anxiety focuses on failure and on things going wrong, whereas my brother Scott, poor Scott, is having his little brother expose his anxieties to
Aww.
The world, but I think he could handle it.
Yeah.
Scott's is focused on illness. He's a hypochondriac, basically, so that, like a lot of people, he feels a twinge in his chest or muscle tightness, and his mind goes to heart attack. Cancer, and he ends up in the hospital having a bunch of expensive tests.
Really?
Whereas for me, yeah, he's, you know, like a lot of people that happens to, they have a panic attack, they end up in the back of an ambulance. Emergency rooms see tons of people every year, thousands who are convinced they're having heart attacks but are really just in the middle of a moment of panic or deep anxiety. I don't go there. Although there are physical sensations for my anxiety, for some reason, I get fixated on the more abstract failure, separation, loss.
Do you feel like the world is a dangerous place?
I do. The world is a dangerous place.
It certainly can be.
It certainly can be. And there's an aspect of pessimism, it seems like you might be getting at, that anxiety, and my anxiety at least, is related to a sense that the world is a dangerous place and the world is a threat to me. It's not my body that's a threat and that might sort of mutiny, but the world around me. Anything can go wrong at any moment and can lead through a cascade of events to my ruination. Sounds crazy the more I describe it out loud.
But it also sounds logical. I mean, in many ways, humans survive because we reacted to dangerous situations and we had that, you know, the fight or flight response, and we were able to evolve and survive.
Yes, and except instead, there are no wolves trying to chase me down. There's just salad dressing in front of me. So right. I think it is very much this primitive impulse that is now channeled into these very mundane things, which is maybe one of the reasons why anxiety is considered a very modern affliction.
Because your mind has to go somewhere, so it goes to salad dressing instead of wolves?
Yeah, because we're not hunters and gatherers anymore, trying to escape predators, or at least most of us aren't. We are people who go to the grocery store and try to decide between Frosted Flakes and Cheerios. And we're faced with these choices, and our bodies, the mind is so absolutely great. It's a genius at fear. The fear response in human beings is vital. It's necessary. Without a fear response, we wouldn't have survived as a species. However, a lot of the things that we had to be fearful of are no longer threats, and yet we're stuck with the response.
You write, being anxious is like being Dick Cheney after 9/11, trumpeting the doctrine of 1%, in which a 1 in 100 chance that the enemy has secured a nuclear bomb is transfigured, poof, into absolute certainty. I chuckled
Absolutely.
At that.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm kind of proud, I confess, of that passage myself. I got a dig in at Dick Cheney, which was nice. And the denominator becomes king. It's that pessimism again. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong. Mm. And your mind gets locked into a habit of thinking in this way. After years of thinking in terms of what can go wrong, it simply becomes a way of life, a way of mind. It becomes your consciousness. It takes over because we're so darn good at it.
Well, I'd love to have you read actually a section from your book, and this is on page 36, talking a bit about what you were like as a kid.
Mm. Happily. This is me as a boy and trying to explain where this came from. I would gladly skip over the mundane examples, your run-of-the-mill fears of the dark, ghosts, the basement, the attic, the woods, animals, doctors, old people, solitude, separation, were it not for the fact that even these anxieties manifested themselves in me with gusto. Among my strongest memories of childhood are of being physically restrained by medical personnel. It was not unusual when I was young for a procedure as routine and non-invasive as a strep culture to set me off like a pig in a barn fire. It often required as many as 4 grown men, one for each scrawny, thrashing limb, to pin me down while a fifth drove home the inoculation or swabbed my swollen tonsils. I can still remember the look that invariably came over the doctor's face as I began to claw at the clinic door and throw fistfuls of tongue depressors at him. It was the same expression the priest in The Exorcist wears when Linda Blair spouts pea soup out his frock. Sometimes grown-ups were conscripted not to restrain me, but to pry me loose from wherever I had affixed myself. Like a tick, I was forever clinging to things for survival. My mother still questions whether she and my father were right to leave me at summer camp when, halfway through a mere 2-week inaugural stint, they paid a visit, and I reacted as if I'd been held hostage by the Iranians and negotiations had just broken down. When they tried to leave, the counselors had to wrench me from the back seat of their car by my ankles. Poor kid.
Well, I was going to say, on the one hand, that's such a clever 2 paragraphs, and there certainly is humor in there. On the other hand, you're describing a terrified child, and that was you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember those moments more vividly than a lot of the happy ones. They've been seared into my memory, that moment of at being left at camp, which repeated itself when I was 18 and was dropped off at college. Mm. was horrifying. And it was horrifying not just because I didn't want to be left, but because I knew or thought that I shouldn't be feeling that way. I was going to summer camp for 2 weeks. I knew my parents would return. I knew I wasn't being abandoned. And I also knew that camp was going to be fun, or that it was, more importantly, to my state of mind, supposed to be fun. What's bad about it?
Sure.
There's fun food. There's camping out. There's games. There's bonfires. And yet everything within me wanted to run as fast as absolutely possible. And so there was a great deal of shame involved in addition to the panic, which was enormously confusing.
You also write about having, you know, little obsessive things, you know, flicking lights on and off, doing certain, you know, counting in a certain kind of way, maybe to keep your active mind occupied somehow.
I think so. Anxiety of the sort that I have and obsessive compulsive tendencies often go hand in hand. And frankly, I haven't looked very deeply into why they go hand in hand in my experience. I still find myself doing that, doing curious little things like counting the backside of my teeth in twos with my tongue.
Oh.
2, 4, 6, 2, 4, 6.
Right.
Or that's the last one that's really stayed with me. And I don't know why I do it. I don't know what it does. It doesn't seem to give me a sense of comfort. If it gives me comfort, maybe it's a subconscious one or just a quiet one. A sense, I know a lot of people indulge in these compulsions because it gives an illusion of control. It's one thing that can be controlled. I do find myself as I get older checking the stove before I leave the house about 4 or 5 or 6 times to make sure that there's not gas leaking out, and can't seem to stop myself from that. But I indulge it. I allow myself those a little bit.
We have about a minute before our first break here. But as you say, you come from an anxious family. And, of course, that always raises that question about nature, nurture, you know, in trying to understand why you have this chronic anxiety.
Yeah. And I think that it's both nature and nurture. I come, as I say in the book, from anxious stock. And it's inevitable that children of people who have these anxious tendencies and whose parents had those anxious tendencies are going to experience them as well. Maybe not inevitable, but probable. At the same time, my mother especially struggled with enormous anxiety. She suffered from panic attacks from the time she was a teenager. And to her great credit, she found a way to deal with them. And now in her 60s, she is far less anxious than she's ever been in her life. But she's a therapist.
I was going to say, she's a therapist.
Yes, she went back to school to become a social worker, to get her degree, and to become a psychotherapist who specializes in the anxiety disorders. And I think, and she concurs, that this was a way of learning more about herself. I think a lot of therapists have a background in personal problems with mental health, which makes perfect sense. It's what interests you, and it's what you want to learn more about.
It's what you know. And that's Daniel Smith, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. We will continue our conversation after this very short break. Another reading as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Their Orthopedic and Spine Institute is performing a procedure called anterior hip replacement. Using a mini incision and specifically designed surgical table, surgeons at Abington and Lansdale Hospitals are able to replace the hip joint through the front rather than the side, sparing muscles. The hospital stay and the recovery time are shorter, enabling patients to return more quickly to regular activities, like driving. More at abingtonhealth.org/bone.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you 2 tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
Going to the beauty shop is about more than getting a new look. It's also a chance to have conversations that give you a new look at the issues that matter to you, from parenting to politics to pop culture. In our beauty shop, a roundtable of women bloggers, journalists, and commentators give their take on the week's news. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Daniel Smith is our guest. He's written a new book called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. He wrote a book a couple of years ago about hearing voices called Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. And we are talking about his and his family's experience of anxiety. And I'd love you, Daniel, to read another section from the book about, it's really about your parents, but it's how you think of them as anxiety sufferers.
Sure. Yeah. This begins with a distinction between what I've discovered are the two different types of anxiety sufferers, which I call stiflers and chaotics. Stiflers are those who work on the principle that if they hold as still, silent, and clenched as possible, they will be able to cut the anxiety off from its energy sources, the way you cinch off the valve on a radiator. It isn't hard to spot a stifler. They tend to look haunted and sleepless, like combat veterans, and they are more likely to chain smoke and pour themselves a drink within 5 minutes of getting home from work. Chaotics, by contrast, work on no principle whatsoever. Although chaotics are sometimes stiflers when alone, around people, and especially in tense interpersonal situations, they are brought into a state of such high psychological pressure that all the valves pop open of their own accord. Everything is released in a geyser of physicality and verbiage, and what you get is a kind of shimmery, barely stable equilibrium between internal and external states, like in those rudimentary cartoons where the outlines of the characters continuously squiggle and undulate. Sometimes the behavior of chaotics is interpreted by laymen as emotional honesty, but it's almost always involuntary. Chaotics are merely stiflers with weak grips.
I thought that was such a fascinating description. And in many ways, the way you write, it sounds like your dad was more a stifler and your mom is perhaps was, because she had some therapy, it was more a chaotic.
Yeah, she's still a chaotic.
She's still
lovable, but a lovable chaotic, an adorable chaotic. My father was a stifler. It was more complicated in his case. Yeah. The first book I wrote that you mentioned about hearing voices was in many respects about my father, whereas this book is very in many respects about my mother. My father had heard voices for many years from the time he was around 13. He was not psychotic, but he heard these voices. Many people do, more than we assume, except he didn't tell anyone for many years, and he held it in. Mm. When his anxiety and his panic came, it was a result of this internal pressure, this secrecy, having this horrible secret that he felt he couldn't tell even his wife and even his best friends, especially not his employers. Whereas my mother had my father as a sort of therapeutic rock when she met him, and he honored who she was, which was someone who struggled with this panic and anxiety, and listened to her and helped her, and perhaps, I'm not sure, indulged her a little bit. And this panic went on for a long time. My mother wears her emotions on her sleeve. She wears her nervousness on her sleeve, which in many ways I respect, because at least you know what you got. You know what's in front of you. It's a very honest way of being.
Well, you and your brother call her Hurricane Marilyn.
Yeah, not the honesty is not always great. But yes, we do. We did for many years, behind her back, call her Hurricane Marilyn. Which, when I showed her the manuscript, I said, "Now listen, Mom, there's something in there." Now, she thought it was hilarious, but she said, "You jerks! I didn't know you were calling me that behind my back." But it's a loving nickname. She's all over the place. She's anxiety is distracting.
Well, it's interesting because you said she's a therapist and mm-hmm. helps people with their own anxiety and perhaps helping with her own anxiety. You write and have written a book about your anxiety, whether therapy and writing has the same kind of beneficial effect.
Writing has no therapeutic effect.
Okay, fair enough.
I get this question a lot, and you wrote a book about anxiety. Did it help you with the anxiety? And it didn't. It helped me to understand the anxiety. It helped me to understand anxiety in general. So maybe I'm being a little disingenuous, because understanding is therapeutic as well, but the only thing that's therapeutic with anxiety is changing the habits of thought. And writing comes with its own problems, and makes you terrified that your work is going to be received poorly. So it raises its own anxieties. The only thing that's therapeutic is learning that how your mind works. My mind works in a certain way. I tell myself things that are going to make me feel anxious. Once I recognize that and learn how to be mindful of it, I can then try to dig new pathways. The problem is I've been anxious for so long, since I'm a kid, and I'm in my 30s now, that the old pathway is always going to be there. It's like those wagon tracks that the old pioneers used to use to get across the country. So many wagon wheels would go in them that they'd be these packed earth ruts. They'll always be there, and the wheels will always slip in them. The only thing you can do is every day dig new tracks and dig a new pathway and keep digging them forever, because otherwise you're just going to slip back in the old ways of thinking. That's been my experience.
What's interesting, though, is that you use cognitive behavioral therapy as a way, I guess, of talking to yourself about what you're thinking. And you also use meditation, which I'm a failed meditator in that whenever I try it, my head just gets consumed with thoughts. It seems like such a contradictory or perhaps interesting way of dealing with your anxiety.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're a failed meditator. I mean, that's what happens. Someone said to me, and I'm a failed meditator too, in that I know it helps, but I don't do it.
Yes.
Because I'm a dummy. And even though I know that it helps, I don't know why I'm so dumb. I know what helps me, and yet I fail to do it every day. But that's what happens when you sit in silence, is that the thoughts come. Someone once said to me that the brain is like a gland, and what it secretes are thoughts. The secret of meditating, well, it's not a secret, I suppose. The rule is you allow yourself to do that, and then you just bring yourself back to the breath. It's a way of disciplining yourself from allowing your own mind to go off on those catastrophic tangents, those melodramatic tangents, and to bring yourself back. And that's why they call it a practice. Mm-hmm. And it has in common with cognitive behavior therapy that mindfulness, that awareness of the mind is something that does things that you might not want it to do, that makes thoughts that you might not want them to make. And you need to have some way of responding to that, some way to discipline your own mind, which is all that is. That's what both of them are.
Well, in fact, your book, Monkey Mind, I mean, that's a Buddhist term.
It is. I took that from the Buddhist literature, and I just found it so evocative, such a beautiful term to describe what it's like to live with a mind that's prone to anxiety, that's prone to this chronic dread and fear, because it feels like monkeys swinging around and in your head and screeching and doing the disgusting flinging of their filth that monkeys do and not stopping, and learning to tame those monkeys, learn to put a collar on them, is the job. I mean, it's the job of all of us, I think. But if you're very anxious, it's certainly what needs to be done.
And that is Daniel Smith. And we are talking about his memoir of anxiety, as he calls it. And the book is called Monkey Mind. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You do describe, and it sounds, to be honest with you, really a traumatic experience as a 16-year-old. And you were seduced, and it sounds like betrayed by two women. What happened?
Yeah, well, I had been working at a bookstore on Long Island where I grew up, and there was a young woman. I now see her as young. I was 15. She was in her early 20s, who took a shine to me as a friend, and I was very kind to her, and she was kind to me. And sometime later, she had quit, and she came back. I'll give the reduced version.
Sure.
And she took my friend and I, gave us a ride upstate. We were going to see a concert, and took us to a party, and asked me, while the party was going on and while we were becoming further and further debauched and smoking pot and drinking a lot, and said, "Would you like to stay at this party when everyone leaves? I'm going to go to a bar and get another woman and bring her back to the apartment." I was a virgin. I was very inexperienced. And I was very frightened, but I was also very inebriated and thought, how do you turn this down? I'm a 16-year-old boy at this point. This seems to be the dream, two women at the same time. But it turned out to be a very traumatic experience for me. immediately afterwards is when my anxiety exploded, when I felt as if something traumatic had befallen me. Before that, I had been a nervous kid, an anxious kid, but it hadn't been chronic. It hadn't been acute. And immediately afterward, the next day we went back to Long Island, and I walked into the house and broke down and told my mother everything, while at the same and in tears, weeping, here's what happened, this is everything that happened, while at the same time feeling enormous shame that I just lost my virginity and 24 hours later divulged it all to my mother, of all people. It was a horrifying thought. And that's when my problems with my anxiety, with my real clinical problems with anxiety, began.
But interestingly, your mother said you were raped.
She was technically correct. The woman was over 18, and I was under 18. I was statutory raped. I don't feel that I was raped. I did have a strange sense, and this might sound odd, that I had raped myself, and that I had performed sexually against my own will. I was not attracted to this woman. I did not want to perform. I was just told by a writer that I should never use the word perform, the verb perform, in the context of sex. That's one of the rules of happiness in life.
I did not know that.
So I should change that. Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? So I was able to do this, and that was very disturbing, that my body could become aroused and could engage in the sexual act despite my not feeling desire. That was a profoundly disturbing thing to realize. To come to realize that there can be this divergence between your body and your wishes was hard. And so that's what I mean by the sense that I had the felt that I had betrayed myself, betrayed my own body, and in a sense raped myself.
And you were being watched by the other woman too, which of course sort of adds to the complexity of the situation.
Oh yeah, it was like, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing in all sorts of weird positions, and I also had sex with both women one at a time. I was not ready for that. It's like that Seinfeld episode where one of them gets an offer for a menage a trois and he goes, I can't do that. If I do that, I'm gonna need to get shag carpeting, I'm gonna need to change all my outfits, I'm gonna need to get, you know, a big medallion around my neck. It was very strange and odd, and I had an idea of perfection. This is a terrible thing and one of the real drivers of my anxiety. But I had an idea that there was a script. There was a way it was supposed to go, particularly your first experiences. And the first time you have sex with someone, it was supposed to be very sweet. It was supposed to be with a girl your age in her basement with a Yes poster on the wall and her father's footfalls quietly overhead and a couple of kittens in the corner and everything lovely and a memory that you create forever. Instead, it was this pornographic memory. Now, I'm now grateful for it because it gives me a great story to tell in bars. But for years afterwards, I was horrified by it.
What and reliving it? I mean, the fantasy and the reality of that sexual experience.
Yeah, the reliving it in my head, but feeling as if there was no going back. I was talking earlier about anxiety is something that you. Thinking about a threat in the future. But my anxiety often works as profound regret. If I hadn't done that, things would be so much better. Now that I have done that, everything is ruined. So it's sort of, I extrapolate from what I believe is an error in the past to a catastrophic future and bypass the present moment. And that was the first time it really exploded so dramatically that I thought there was a way that this was supposed to go. And it didn't go that way. And because of that, it's going to be a mess from here on out. I also thought that perhaps I had contracted HIV, which was impossible. There was a great deal of protection. And yet that disease fear, that AIDS fear, really took over for several months in high school.
I don't mean this to sound like you were a selfish person, but it sounds like with anxiety that there is a lot of I mean that there's a lot of focus on self.
Oh, it's awful. That's the great incantation. I. That's anxiety. It is being locked into your own head, and it is terrible if you want to be a good and loving person. When you're anxious, everything is about you and your own welfare. And it can be very hard to have productive, happy relationships when you're in the midst of that. It's like locked-in syndrome, I thought of it at one point. Like that book which was made into a movie, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Oh, indeed. Fantastic movie, yes.
Fantastic and a wonderful book, and you're stuck in your own head, and it feels that way. It feels as if you cannot escape your own skull. And that makes it very difficult to see people well, to see them and to love them. And if that's an aspiration of yours, if you want to be a good person, it also comes with a great deal of guilt because you don't want to be selfish. And yet it's there. It seizes you like a fever. And it's a fever of selfhood, of self-obsession.
You described the anxiety that you had at camp. You also had anxiety about being dropped off at Brandeis, where you went to college. It sounds like you not just hid in the library, but you found great comfort reading books like Philip Roth's novels. That was a way for you to understand what you were going through. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Yeah, I had escaped the library because it afforded some solitude. And I found that in books, I had a great therapeutic tool. I'd been in therapy before and I didn't quite like it. You had to keep answering questions. if a book, and you had to sit there for the whole 45 minutes, otherwise you were rude or you're wasting money. With a book, you can open up the cover, and if it comforted you and it helped you and you taught you something, you can keep going. If it made you anxious, you could slam the cover shut, replace it on the shelf, and get a new one. And they don't talk back, which is a nice thing. So Philip Roth, when I discovered Philip Roth's novels, it was almost like discovering the Rosetta Stone. Wow. For my own anxiety. We had very similar backgrounds, by which I mean we had slightly, or at least the characters, I should say, because I don't know Philip Roth and I don't know his life or biography that well. But the characters had histrionic Jewish mothers. There seemed to be an ethnic aspect to anxiety that I found quite true to my own experience. Often the dilemma that a Philip Roth character goes through is as follows. I want the love of my family. I cherish the love of my family. The love of my family is enormously important to me and defines me, on the one hand. On the other hand, I wish I can escape the love and affection of my family. I wish I could separate. I wish I could service my own ego. I wish I could be a bad person and not want to be the mensch all the time. How do you do these two things, being pulled in two different directions at the same time? And you can't get out of your head the voices of your family, of your parents, of your superego, who think they know what they want, what's good for you, and perhaps do, and you might believe them at the same time as you resent them. And this was a very sort of ethnic dilemma, I thought, and it was enormously important to me. I learned a great deal about anxiety from those books.
Well, I do want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Daniel Smith about his life and his memoir. The memoir is called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hispanic Institute at LaSalle University supports WHYY and announces a new master's program in translation and interpretation that addresses three main environments: business, legal, and healthcare, where translation and interpretation involving English and Spanish is currently needed and will continue to be in the future. Details at 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/Hispanic Institute. LaSalle University. Choose LaSalle for your master's in translation and interpretation.
On the next Fresh Air, Kenneth Lonergan talks about writing and directing the film Margaret, which was described in The New Yorker as nothing short of a masterpiece. It was completed in 2006, but because of lawsuits, it didn't open until last year and was shown in few theaters. Now it's out on DVD. Lonergan also made You Can Count on Me. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. When Reggie Shaw was 19, he killed two men because he was texting while driving. Now he's helped pass one of the toughest anti-texting and driving laws in the country. His is a cautionary tale. Also, actress Anna Gunn of AMC's Breaking Bad, what will happen in the final season? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Daniel Smith about anxiety and his memoir called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. I should add that he is a co-producer, co-host of the occasional podcast of the literary magazine N Plus One. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel, I just want to quote something that you wrote recently in the New York Times. The headline was, Do the Jews Own Anxiety? And you talk about making up a baseball team or putting a baseball team together made up of anxious players, and you were at Rosh Hashanah asking a bunch of friends this question. The answer I got, let me read what you said instead of trying to summarize it here. You said, last Rosh Hashanah, I asked a group of friends this question, and the answer I got suggested that the team would be exclusively Jewish. Responses included, but were not limited to, the following: the Los Angeles Kvetches, the Brooklyn Nazi Dodgers, the Kansas City Moyles, the Chicago Schlubs, the Miami Michiganas, the Westchester Rhinoplasties, the Hollywood Ingestives, and my favorite, this is you, a late entry from my brother Scott, the Upper West Side Atavans. The idea that if you were to put a baseball team together of all anxious players, they would all be Jewish.
Yeah, and it turns out that it's not true.
Exactly.
The Jews have not cornered the market on anxiety. It's a universal emotion, and if you put together that baseball team, you'd have people like Soren Kierkegaard and William James and Charles Darwin, who suffered terribly from panic attacks and crippling nervous illness, which they've tried to discover the cause of for many years, and half of the Book of Saints, the lives of the saints, those people would have to be in there. But the Jews are enormously good, and I should point out that despite the fact that my last name is Smith, that is what they call an Ellis Island name. It was either changed by my great grandfather or by a clerk at Ellis Island, and it was originally Gamulski. But the Jews have been better than anyone else at dramatizing anxiety, at showing the dilemma of what it's like to be someone who can't get out of their own head. And of course, we all know, we can all talk about the great examples, Philip Roth, the Coen Brothers movies, and of course, Woody Allen. And there's good reasons for that. But I also think that it's very much an immigrant thing, an American immigrant thing. The other immigrant groups who come to the United States become very good at that, at representing anxiety, once they start to experience the generational dilemmas. Do I stick with the traditional from which I've received so much, or do I assimilate and try to become individual and individualistic and independent? There's enormous anxiety in that tension.
Yeah. You mentioned Woody Allen. I just saw his new movie, and he exemplifies someone who tries, sometimes fails, sometimes succeeds, but finding humor in anxiety. And I read that in your book as well.
Yeah. And I should say that I think Woody Allen, the real Woody Allen, is probably the least anxious person in the country. I know it sounds crazy, but I saw this documentary that they ran, I think, on PBS, a wonderful two-part documentary that a lot of people saw. And the word that everyone used to describe him was compartmentalized, and he used it to describe himself. He is able, even in terrible crises like his public dispute with Mia Farrow and the horrible fallout from that, was able to work, was able to produce. The man has produced so many movies, so many books, done so much work consistently that it exhibits to me, it shows to me that he's someone who can leave his anxiety aside. Whereas I feel like I have just one single compartment where everything's just swimming around. It's a big mucky mess in there. So, yeah, I think Woody Allen is not anxious at all. But now I've forgotten the question and I'm getting anxious. I'm sorry.
No. I don't want to get anxious, but I do want to ask you about the experience you had at Atlantic Monthly, and not to have you relive it, but I have to say I think I think anyone would be very anxious about what happened. You wrote an article about electroshock therapy led to a multi-million dollar libel suit. And under those circumstances, I can't imagine anyone not being terrifically anxious.
Oh, that was horrific.
I can imagine.
Was so young. I was lucky enough to get a position as a staff editor at The Atlantic. This is when they were in Boston, right after college. And I was working as a fact checker, which is a terrible job for someone who suffers from anxiety.
Sure.
Talk about the need for perfection. And in my spare time, I wrote an article about electroconvulsive therapy. I hadn't been aware that it was still being done. And I was certainly not aware that there was a great controversy, a long-time controversy, over the use of it, a sophisticated controversy to some extent. And I wrote a very long article, and it was published in The Atlantic when I was around 22, I think, or 23. Mm-hmm. And it was a very long article, and it was anthologized in one of those Best American series. And it unleashed a great deal of furor. It's a very controversial subject.
Sure.
And I wasn't prepared for it. I'd never published anything before. People who feel strongly against electroconvulsive therapy feel very strongly about it. They're often people who have had their memory depleted by the experience. Sometimes they were forced into it against their will, even though electroshock therapy has done lots of good for many people. There are some risks involved. And afterward, everything just, the world came down on my head. I had people writing on the internet that my article would result in the deaths of people from suicide. Mm. That I had done a terrible ill for the world, that I didn't know what I was doing, that I'd gotten everything wrong, even though the article was thoroughly fact-checked, that I'd really hurt people, when all I'd wanted to do was learn how to report and write and publish an article and to do it very seriously and very earnestly. And to think that I'd hurt people was crushing. And I didn't write again for a year and a half or two. I couldn't, and I descended into the third truly serious episode of anxiety in my life that caused me to break up with, caused the dissolution of a very serious relationship with the woman who, very luckily, is now my wife, but I was unable to love or to receive or give love because I was so consumed by anxiety in the wake of that experience.
And it sounds like traumatized by all the negative reaction. Of course, having a threatened lawsuit like that is a frightening experience. Does it feel more distant now? I mean, do you feel like you have some distance on that whole experience? It was a while ago.
I do feel like I have some distance. Although writing that part of the book, I found to my surprise that some of that anxiety came back. I didn't realize that the sense of trauma I'd felt from that experience. The lawsuit came sometime later, and at a time when I had left The Atlantic, I had moved to New York, and I had almost no money in my bank account. So the prospect of a multi-million dollar lawsuit at that point was almost laughable to me because what are you going to take? I don't have anything. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I had gone to therapy and learned cognitive behavioral techniques and was in a good place. But when I went and started to write this section, it did bring back a lot of the sense of threat. Why invite that vitriol into my life and into my home again? People feel so passionately about this procedure. It would be like, it's like writing about abortion. But I don't take a position on it in the book. And in fact, I apologize to some extent for the article. Not because I think it's a bad article or because it was done in bad faith. It wasn't. But because I was green and I would have been more sophisticated in my tone, more sophisticated in how I presented the material, and more sensitive to the realities of the experience of certain people who have something at stake in this subject. I'm far more experienced now, but I did feel again a pang to my surprise once I opened up that can of worms again.
Mm. Do you feel, though, that you have to be perfect as a writer? You've gotten, I have to say, some very nice reviews on this book, and that must make you feel good. But nonetheless, you know, there are the world of blogs and internet out there. And do you feel like you have to please everybody or mostly yourself? Or where does perfection stand for you today?
I feel less and less perfectionist. In my writing, which is where I experience this a lot. You know, a lot of people write and then they revise. I perfect every sentence as I go on, and then I revise further. And it's a very slow and arduous process for me, and I'm trying very consciously to change that, because perfection, as someone said, is the devil.
Yeah.
And there's not a great deal of fun to be had there, or a lot of looseness. As far as reviews and how the world perceives me, I do have some of that. And when I read these positive reviews, which I've been very lucky to have, I often think, maybe crazily, they're totally wrong.
Oh, is that right? That's the other side.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. They have no idea. This is crap. This thing's crap. I'll do much better next time, I promise. I want to call them up, even though they've just said, you know, this is a perfect 10. No. I think, what scale? Is it 10 out of 20?
Oh, there you go.
I read through the piece. It's nuts. And it's hard. It's hard to enjoy those things. But the perfectionist mm-hmm. tendencies have been, I've been fighting against them. I've been fighting to chip away at them for many years now. And I'm a father now, and you fail so frequently as a parent that you get used to failure. And every year that I get older, I fail. I say something that I didn't want to say and that maybe hurt someone's feelings. I do something that I didn't want to do. I write in a way that I think I could have done better. And so I assimilate the idea, and I come to terms with the idea that life is failure. And that's the great thing about it. But that, you hit on something that's, I think, the daily mission of my life, to see that fact for what it is.
Well, and kids do a great job of taking it out of yourself.
Yeah, and teaching you humility. And teaching you humility. And it's a great thing. Whenever I'm anxious, or whenever I check my Amazon sales rankings too much, or who's following me on Twitter, I find myself becoming self-obsessed, or obsessed with the fleeting things like success, or attention, or invitations to do wonderful conversations on the radio like this. I just turn everything off and I just get down on the floor and play with my daughter. And that helps. It's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of perspective and getting out of your own head.
Your mother figures into this book that you've written, and at your blog, monkeymindchronicles.com, there's a Friday feature called Ask Dan's Mom, and your mom is a therapist. Where did that come from?
I thought it'd be funny. I thought she has so much to offer. She, you know, she's had some troubles dealing with my anxiety because she's a therapist, but she's also my mom.
Right.
So she has to toggle between those two modes, and she can't be my therapist because she is my mom, and those impulses are different. But I have seen her in her therapeutic mode, and she strikes me as brilliant at it. And she tells me about some of the things her patients say after they've left therapy about how she's changed their lives. She's not immodest about it, but she's so grateful when she receives these things. And so I thought, my mom has a lot to offer. So let's put out a call for people to write in and asking questions about anxiety. It's a tricky thing because she can't give therapy over my goofy website, but she can offer some guiding principles, which is almost always involves the advice to breathe. She's a big believer in therapeutic breathing. She's got signs all over the house that just say breathe, because it's never really done it for me, and she thinks I'm crazy for not trying it in a more dedicated fashion. But slowing down your breathing, leveling off the blood chemistry, having something to focus on, all these things she finds enormously helpful, so that if I'm making her tense, she automatically starts breathing, which then makes me tense because I realize I'm making her tense. And then it's just a mess and we get into a fight.
Well, you know, she is your mom.
She is my mom.
Another thing that, and we're almost out of time here, another thing that you write about is that you're a big sweater, if I can say.
Oh, yeah.
You used to use maxi pads and now you use Botox. Did I read that right?
You read that absolutely right.
Wow.
This has been, it was humiliating. I mean, when I was at The Atlantic, that's the only office job I've really had, you know, a full-time job. I've been a freelance writer for a long time. But I would have to go to the bathroom every 10 minutes to scrub the underside of my shirt because the sweat marks would start to seep through my undershirt and into the underarms of my shirt and make these horrible dark stains so that I'd have to walk around with my arms pinned to my side like Frankenstein. And this went on for years. I think it's one of the reasons I became a writer, seriously, because then I could sweat as copiously as I want and no one would see me and I wouldn't have to be humiliated. And then I started teaching and I had to find out a way. And my wife one day came back from Costco with a giant box of maxi pads. She said, this is going to last me through menopause. And it hasn't because I started to use them, affix them to the inside of my shirt to soak up the sweat. There wasn't that much rustling. I'd have to move a little less so that people didn't hear that there were maxi pads under my arms. But then my dermatologist told me that they can use Botox for what's called hyperhidrosis and essentially paralyze the sweat glands under your arms. So I looked into it, and I got a consultation, and they said, well, you can do this, and very, very rarely there's something called compensatory sweating. So we'll paralyze the sweat glands under your arms, and your nostrils will start sweating, or your the side of your head. Probably this won't happen. I was convinced that I was going to be the one poor guy whose shoulder was going to get shoulder sweating or something. But it's worked, and it's worked like a dream, and it lasts for about 6 months. And it looks very strange when I go running because everything's sweating but my underarms. But it's changed my life. It's absolutely changed my life. It's the best thing. I'm dry as the Sahara. And it doesn't. You don't get into that cycle where you get sweating and then you're anxious that someone's seeing you sweating. And so that makes you sweat more. It's cut out that cycle. It's just sliced it off.
Well, on that note, Daniel... I had more questions, but we are out of time. Oh, Daniel Smith, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And the book is called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.